This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Ah, and I'm certain my reflection is waiting at the bottom of the glass after the last sip of golden wheaten hops that grew in the wilds of a far-off field, and after several stops by the bathroom to take in my waterlogged image, altered with swimming eyes and faltering smile. I hide in the bottom of the pint, swimming myself to the surface or drowning myself at the base, treading toward the brash idea of a new day or way of viewing each of us. I'm tapping warmth into each word that I pour into the empty ears of the other dizzy heads that bob and weave like fish in streams, swimming toward a greater pond or lake or gigantic ocean. They're drowning themselves too.
I'm going to have to apologize to Sterling and everyone who was hoping to hear a read. You'll have to just go to that event on June 30th and be filmed. And where is that? Is that the Jade Lounge? And all of you, and I'd like to thank all of you, Camille, Sterling, Laura, and Lisa.
Thanks for having us. Yeah,
thanks.
And stay tuned for Gremlin Time.
Station Navigator Report, June 14th, 2013. Recently, I announced a renewed effort to both survey the community to better understand what they want and need from their community radio station and to recruit many more financially supporting and voting members. Today, we launched the first survey in this campaign. True to KBOO's mandate to serve the underserved, and knowing that thousands in the greater Portland metro area have no access to progressive talk radio since the demise of KPOJ last winter, we are asking the question, would you like to hear the Tom Hartman Show Monday through Friday on KBOO? What does this mean in terms of airtime to meet the needs of the outcast liberal progressives in Portland? 15 hours out of the 168 hours, KBOO is on the air each week. Please go to kboo.fm and look for Tom Hartman on KBOO, then take this two-question survey. If you are not currently a member, please join us today. Pass the link along to others. We need to hear from the entire community if we are to make informed decisions. Please understand that this is only an informational gathering survey to guide possible future programming changes. Please contact me if you have questions or concern. My door is always open. This has been KBOO Station Manager, Development Director, Executive Director, and Ever Watchful Navigator, Lynn Fitch. Thanks.
This is Community Radio for the Northwest, KBOO Portland. Coming up at midnight, Joe Woods and the Tiki Cha-Cha Club. Right now, the following program contains adult language and adult situations. But of course, it's the bedtime radio show for grown-ups. It's Gremlin Time.
September in Santa Teresa. I've never known anyone yet who doesn't suffer a certain restlessness when autumn rolls around. It's the season of new school clothes, fresh notebooks, and finely sharpened pencils without any teeth marks in the wood. We're all 8 years old again, and anything is possible. The new year should never begin on January 1. It begins in the fall and continues as long as our saddle Oxfords remain unscuffed and our lunch boxes have no dents. My name is Kinsey Milhone. I'm female, 32, twice divorced, doing business as Kinsey Milhone Investigations in a little town 95 miles north of Los Angeles. Isn't a walk-in trade like a beauty salon. Most of my clients find themselves in a bind and then seek my services, hoping I can offer a solution for a mere $30 an hour, plus expenses.
You are entering a zone of sound and imagery, a landscape of frequency, a vocabulary of modulation. There is the signpost up ahead. Please adjust your chronometers. This is Gremlin Time.
Well, good evening and welcome to Gremlin Time. This is Fortunato. Tonight, we're going to present a story by Sue Grafton with her famous private eye, Kinsey Millhone. And this appears in a collection called Kinsey and Me, as well as some other short stories that she wrote concerning her mother's death. But these are some of her great little detective short stories from her novels, which are go through the whole alphabet from A, and she hasn't quite gotten to Z yet. But this is a short story called She Didn't Come Home.
Robert Ackerman's message was waiting on my answering machine that Monday morning at 9 when I got in.
Hello, my name is Roger Ackerman, and I wonder if you could give me a call. My wife is missing, and I'm worried sick. I was hoping you could help me out.
In the background, I could hear whiny children, my favorite kind. He repeated his name and gave me a telephone number. I made a pot of coffee before I called him back. A little person answered the phone. And then I heard a lot of heavy breathing close to the mouthpiece. Hi, I said. Can I speak to your daddy? Long silence. Today, I asked. The receiver was clunked down on a tabletop, and I could hear the clatter of footsteps in a room that sounded as if it didn't have any carpeting. In due course, Robert Ackerman picked up the phone.
Lucy?
It's Kinsey Millhone, Mr. Ackerman. I just got your message on my answering machine. Can you tell me what's going on?
Oh, wow, yeah.
He was interrupted by a piercing shriek that sounded like one of those policeman whistles you use to discourage obscene phone callers. I didn't jerk back quite in time. I listened patiently while he dealt with the errant child.
Sorry,
he said when he came back on the line.
Look, is there any way you could come out to the house? I've got my hands full. I just can't get away.
I took his address and brief directions, then headed out to my car. Robert and the missing Mrs. Ackerman lived in a housing tract that looked like it was built in the 40s, before anyone ever dreamed up the notion of family rooms, country kitchens, and his and her solar spas. What we had here was a basic drywall box, a cramped living room with a dining L, a kitchen, and one bathroom sandwiched between two 9-by-12-foot bedrooms. When Robert answered the door, I could just about see the whole place at a glance. The only thing the builders had been lavish with was the hardwood floors, which in this case was unfortunate. Little children had banged and scraped these floors and had brought in some kind of foot grip that I sensed before I was even asked to step inside. Robert, though harried, had a boyish appeal. A man in his early 30s, perhaps lean and handsome, with dark eyes and dark hair that came to a pixie point in the middle of his forehead. He was wearing chinos and a plain white t-shirt. He had a baby, maybe 8 months old, propped on his hip like a grocery bag. Another child clung to his right leg, while a third rode his tricycle at various walls and doorways, making quite loud sounds with his mouth.
Hi, come on in. We can talk out in the backyard while the kids play.
His smile was sweet. I followed him through the tiny, disorganized house and out to the backyard, where he set the baby down in a sand pile framed with 2x4s. The second child held on to Robert's belt loops and stuck a thumb in its mouth, staring at me while the tricycle child tried to ride off the edge of the porch. I'm not fond of children. I'm really not. Especially the kind who wear hard brown shoes. Like dogs, these infants sensed my distaste and kept their distance, eyeing me with a mixture of rancor and disdain. The backyard was scruffy, fenced in, and littered with the 50-pound sacks the sand had come in. Robert gave the children homemade-style cookies out of a cardboard box and shooed them away. In 15 minutes, the sugar would probably turn them into lunatics. I gave my watch a quick glance, hoping to be gone by then.
You want a lawn chair?
No, this is fine, I said, and settled on the grass. There wasn't a lawn chair in sight, but the offer was nice anyway. He perched on the edge of the sandbox and ran a distracted hand across his head.
God, I'm sorry everything is such a mess, but Lucy hasn't been here for 2 days. She didn't come home from work on Friday, and I've been a wreck ever since.
I take it you notified the police.
Sure, Friday night. She never showed up at the babysitter's house to pick the kids up. I finally got a call here at 7 asking where she was. I figured she'd stop off at the grocery store or something. So I went ahead and picked him up and brought him home. By 10 o'clock, when I hadn't heard from her, I knew something was wrong. I called her boss at home, and he said, as far as he knew, she'd left work at 5, as usual. So that's when I called the police.
You filed a missing persons report?
I can do that today. With an adult, you have to wait 72 hours. And even then, there's not much they can do.
What else did they suggest?
The usual stuff, I guess. I mean, I called everyone we know. I talked to her mom in Bakersfield and this friend of hers at work. Nobody has any idea where she is. I'm scared something's happened to her.
You've checked with hospitals in the area, I take it?
Sure, that's the first thing I did.
Did she give you any indication that anything was wrong?
Not a word.
Was she depressed or behaving oddly?
Well, she was kind of restless the past couple months. She always seemed to get excited around this time of the year. She said it reminded her of her old elementary school days.
He shrugged.
I hated mine.
But she's never disappeared like this before?
Oh, heck no. I just mentioned her mood because you asked. I don't think it amounted to anything.
Does she have any problem with alcohol or drugs?
Lucy isn't really like that. She's petite and kind of quiet. A homebody, I guess you'd say.
Do the two of you get along okay?
As far as I'm concerned, we do. I mean, once in a while we get into it, but never anything serious.
What are your disagreements about? He smiled ruefully.
Money, mostly. With 3 kids, we never seem to have enough. I mean, I'm crazy about big families, but it's tough financially. I always wanted 4 or 5, but she says 3 is plenty, especially with the oldest not in school yet. We fight about that some, having more kids.
You both work?
We have to, just to make ends meet. She has a job at an escrow company downtown, and I work for the phone company.
Doing what?
Installing.
Has there been any hint of someone else in her life?
In a way, I wish I could say yes.
He sighed, plucking at the grass between his feet.
I'd like to think maybe she just got fed up or something and checked into a motel for a weekend. Something like that.
But you don't think she did?
I'm going crazy with anxiety. Somebody's got to find out where she is.
Mr. Ackerman.
You can call me Rob.
Clients always say that. I mean, unless their names are something else. Rob, I said, the police are truly your best bet in a situation like this. I'm just one person. They've got a vast machinery they can put to work, and it won't cost you a cent.
You charge a lot, huh?
$30 an hour plus expenses. He thought about that for a moment. Then he gave me a searching look.
Could you maybe put in 10 hours? I've got $300 we were saving for a trip to the San Diego Zoo.
I pretended to think about it, but the truth was, I knew I couldn't say no to that boyish face. Anyway, the kids were starting to whine, and I wanted to get out of there. I waved the retainer and said I'd send him an itemized bill when the 10 hours were up. I figured I could put a contract in the mail and reduce my contact with the short persons who were crowding around him now, begging for more sweets. I asked for a recent photograph of Lucy, but all he could come up with was a 2-year-old snapshot of her with the 2 older kids. She looked beleaguered even then, and that was before the 3rd baby came along. I thought about the quiet little Lucy Ackerman whose 3 strapping sons had legs the size of my arms. If I were she, I knew where I'd be. Long gone. Lucy Ackerman was employed as an escrow officer for a small company on State Street, not far from my office. It was a modest establishment of white walls, rust and brown plaid furniture with burnt orange carpeting. There were Gauguin reproductions all around and a live plant on every desk. I introduced myself first to the office manager, a Mrs. Merriman, who was in her 60s, had tall hair, and wore lace-up boots with stiletto heels. She looked like a woman who'd trade all her pension monies for a head-to-toe body tuck. Robert Ackerman has asked me to see if I can locate his wife.
Well, the poor man. I heard about that,
she said with her mouth. Her eyes said, fat chance. Do you have any idea where she might be?
I think you'd better talk to Mr. Sutherland.
She had turned all prim and officious, but my guess was she knew something and was dying to be asked. I intended to accommodate her as soon as I talked to him. I've found the protocol in small offices, is ironclad. Gavin Sutherland got up from his swivel chair and stretched a big hand across the desk to shake mine. The other member of the office force, Barbara Hemdahl, a bookkeeper, got up from her chair simultaneously and excused herself. Mr. Sutherland watched her depart and then motioned me into the same seat. I sank into leather still hot from Barbara Hemdahl's backside. A curiously intimate effect. I made a mental note to find out what she knew, and then I looked with interest at the company vice president. I picked up all these names and job titles because his was cast in stand-up bronze letters on his desk, and the two women both had white plastic name tags affixed to their breasts, like nurses. As nearly as I could tell, there were only four of them in the office, including Lucy Ackerman, and I couldn't understand how they could fail to identify each other on sight. Maybe all the badges were for clients who couldn't be trusted to tell one from the other without the proper IDs. Gavin Sutherland was large, an ex-jock to all appearances, maybe 45 years old, with a heavy head of blonde hair thinning slightly at the crown. He had a slight paunch, a slight stoop to his shoulders, and a grip that was damp with sweat. He had his coat off, and his once starched white shirt was limp and wrinkled, his beige gabardine pants heavily creased across the lap. Altogether, he looked like a man who'd just crossed a continent by rail. Still, I was forced to credit him with good looks, even if he had let himself go to seed.
Nice to meet you, Miss Milhone. I'm glad you're here.
His voice was deep and rumbling, with confidence-inspiring undertones. On the other hand, I didn't like the look in his eyes. He could have been a con man for all I knew.
I understand Mrs. Ackerman never got home Friday night.
That's what I'm told. Can you tell me anything about her day here? He studied me briefly.
Well, now, I'm going to have to be honest with you. Our bookkeeper has come across some discrepancies in the accounts. It looks like Lucy Ackerman has just walked off with $500,000 entrusted to us.
How'd she manage that? I was picturing Lucy Ackerman, free of those truck-busting kids, lying on a beach in Rio, slurping some kind of rum drink out of a coconut. Mr. Sutherland looked pained.
In the most straightforward manner imaginable. It looks like she opened a new bank account at a branch in Montebello, deposited 10 checks there that should have gone into other accounts. Last Friday, she withdrew over $500,000 in cash, claiming we were closing out a big real estate deal. We found the passbook in her bottom drawer.
He tossed the booklet across the desk to me, and I picked it up. The word void had been punched into the pages in a series of holes. A quick glance showed 10 deposits at intervals dating back over the past 3 months and a zero balance as of last Friday's date. Didn't anybody else double-check this stuff?
We'd just undergone our annual audit in June. Everything was fine. We trusted this woman implicitly and had every reason to.
You discovered the loss this morning?
Yes, ma'am, but I'll admit I was suspicious Friday night when Robert Ackerman called me at home. It was completely unlike that woman to disappear without a word. She's worked here 8 years, and she's been punctual and conscientious since the day she walked in.
Well, punctual at any rate. Have you notified the police?
I was just about to do that. I'll have to alert the Department of Corporations, too. God, I can't believe she did this to us. I'll be fired. I'll probably shut this entire office down.
Would you mind if I had a quick look around?
Well, to what end?
There's always a chance we can figure out where she went. If we move fast enough, maybe we can catch her before she gets away with it.
Well, I doubt that. The last anybody saw her was Friday afternoon. That's 2 full days. She could be anywhere by now.
Mr. Sutherland, her husband has already authorized $300 worth of my time. Why not take advantage of it? He stared at me.
Won't the police object?
Probably, but I don't intend to get in anybody's way, and whatever I find out, I'll turn over to them. They may not be able to get a fraud detective out here until late morning anyway. If I get a line on her, it'll make you look good to the company and to the cops. He gave a sigh of resignation and waved his hand.
Hell, I don't care. Do what you want.
When I left his office, he was putting the call through to the police department. I sat briefly at Lucy's desk, which was neat and well organized. Her drawers contained the usual office supplies, no personal items at all. There was a calendar on her desktop, one of those loose leaf affairs with a page for each day. I checked back through the past couple of months. The only personal notation was for an appointment at the Women's Health Center, August 2nd, and a second visit last Friday afternoon. It must have been a busy day for Lucy, what with a doctor's appointment and ripping off her company for $500,000? I made a note of the address she'd penciled in at the time of her first visit. The other two women in the office were keeping an eye on me, I noticed, though both pretended to be occupied with paperwork. When I finished my search, I got up and crossed the room to Mrs. Merriman's desk. Is there any way I can make a copy of the passbook or the account Mrs. Ackerman opened?
Well, yes, if Mr. Sutherland approves.
I'm also wondering where she kept her coat and purse during the day.
In the back. We each have a locker in the storage room.
I'd like to take a look at that, too. I waited patiently while she cleared both matters with her boss, and then I accompanied her to the rear. There was a door that opened into the parking lot. To the left of it was a small restroom, and on the right, there was a storage room that housed four connecting upright metal lockers, the copy machine, and numerous shelves neatly stacked with office supplies. Each shoulder-high locker was marked with a name. Lucy Ackerman's was still securely padlocked. There was something about the blank look of that locker that seemed ominous somehow. I looked at the lock, fairly itching to have a crack at it with my little set of key picks, but I didn't want to push my luck with the cops on the way. "I'd like for someone to let me know what's in that locker when it's finally opened," I remarked while Mrs. Merriman ran off the copy of the passbook pages for me. "This too," I said, handing her a carbon of the withdrawal slip Lucy's been required to sign in receipt of the cash. It had been folded and tucked into the back of the booklet. "You have any theories about where she went?" Mrs. Merriman's mouth pursed piously, as though she were debating with herself about how much she might say.
"I wouldn't want to be accused of talking out of school."
"Mrs. Merriman, it does look like a crime's been committed. Police are going to ask you the same thing when they get here."
"No. Well, in that case, I suppose it's all right. I mean, I don't have the faintest idea where she is, but I do think she's been acting oddly for the past few months."
"Like what?"
"She seems secretive. Smug. Like she knew something the rest of us didn't know about."
"That certainly turned out to be the case."
"So, I didn't mean it was related to that. I think she was having an affair."
That got my attention. An affair? With whom? She paused for a moment, touching at one of the hairpins that supported her ornate hairdo. She allowed her gaze to stray back toward Mr. Sutherland's office. I turned and looked in that direction, too. No wonder he was in a sweat, I thought.
"I couldn't swear to it, but his marriage has been rocky for years, and I gather she hasn't been that happy herself. And she has those beastly little boys, you know, and a husband who seems determined to spawn more. She and Mr. Sutherland, Gavvy, she calls him, have, well, I'm sure they've been together. Whether it's connected to this matter of the missing money, I wouldn't presume to guess."
Having said as much, she was suddenly uneasy.
"You wouldn't repeat what I've said to the police, I hope."
"Absolutely not. Unless they ask, of course."
"Of course.
By the way, is there a company travel agent?"
"Right next door."
I had a brief chat with the bookkeeper, who added nothing to the general picture of Lucy Ackerman's last few days at work. I retrieved my VW from the parking lot and headed over to the health center 8 blocks away, wondering what Lucy had been up to. I was guessing birth control and probably the permanent sort. If she were having an affair, and determined not to get pregnant again in any event, it would seem logical. But I hadn't any idea how to verify the fact. Medical personnel are notoriously stingy with information like that. I parked in front of the clinic and grabbed my clipboard from the back seat. I have a supply of all-purpose forms for occasions like this. They look like a cross between a job application and an insurance claim. I filled one out now in Lucy's name and forged her signature at the bottom where it said, "Authorization to Release Information." As a model, I used the Xerox copy of the withdrawal slip she'd tucked into her passbook. I'll admit, my methods would be considered unorthodox, nay, illegal, in the eyes of law enforcement officers everywhere. But I reasoned that the information I was seeking would never actually be used in court, and therefore it couldn't matter that much how it was obtained. I went into the clinic, noting gratefully the near-empty waiting room. I approached the counter and took out my wallet with my California Fidelity ID. I do occasional insurance investigations for CF in exchange for office space, They once made the mistake of issuing me a company identification card with my picture right on it that I've been flashing around quite shamelessly ever since. I had a choice of three female clerks, and after a brief assessment, I made eye contact with the oldest of them. In places like this, younger employees usually have no authority at all and are, thus, impossible to con. People without authority will often simply stand there, reciting the rules like minor birds. Having no power, they also seem to take a vicious satisfaction in forcing others to comply. The woman approached the counter on her side, looking at me expectantly. I showed my CFID and made the form on the clipboard conspicuous, as though I had nothing to hide. Hi, my name is Kinsey Milhone. I wonder if you can give me some help. Your name is what? She seemed wary of the request, as though her name had magical powers that might be taken from her by force.
Lillian Vincent, what sort of help did you need?
Lucy Ackerman has applied for some insurance benefits, and we need verification of the claim. You'll want a copy of the release form for your files, of course. I passed the forged paper to her and then busied myself with my clipboard as though it were all perfectly matter-of-fact. She was instantly alert.
What is this?
I gave her a look. Oh, sorry. She's applying for maternity leave and we need her due date.
Maternity leave?
Isn't she a patient here? Lillian Vincent looked at me.
Just a moment.
She went to a file cabinet and extracted a chart, returning to the counter. She pushed it over to me.
The woman has had a tubal ligation.
I blinked, smiling slightly as though she were making a joke. There must be some mistake.
Lucy Ackerman must have made it if she thinks she can pull this off.
She opened the chart and tapped significantly at the August 2nd date.
She was just in here on Friday for a final checkup and a medical release. She's sterile.
I looked at the chart. Sure enough, that's what it said. I raised my eyebrows and then shook my head slightly. God, well, I guess I'd better have a copy of that.
I should think so.
The woman said and ran one off for me on the desktop dry copier. She placed it on the counter and watched as I tucked it into my clipboard.
I don't know how they think they can get away with it.
People love to cheat.
You're listening to She Didn't Come Home by Sue Grafton, read to us this evening on Gremlin Time by Scarlett Tuffington, and backed up by our 3D radio players. This is KBOO Portland, and we're going to take a small break from our detective story.
Missing her son.
Fine young cannibals here. Well, you're listening to Gremlin Time. This is Fortunato. Tonight we're presenting a short story by mystery writer Sue Grafton. I believe she used to be a screenwriter and then just gave it up. And she started this series with the detective Kinsey Millhone, and each novel has a letter of the alphabet. And because it's like sort of following the real time in the gal's life, the stories take place back in the 70s, back when she started writing them, so before computers and everything. So they become a nice nostalgic thing. This is from a collection called Kinsey and Me. Let's return now to our short story, She Didn't Come Back. I mean, She Didn't Come Home, by Sue Grafton.
It was nearly noon by the time I got back to the travel agency next door to the place where Lucy Ackerman had worked. It didn't take any time at all to unearth the reservation she'd made 2 weeks before. Buenos Aires, first class on Pan Am. For one. She'd picked up the ticket Friday afternoon just before the agency closed for the weekend. The travel agent rested his elbows on the counter and looked at me with interest, hoping to hear all the gory details, I'm sure.
I heard about the business next door.
He was young, maybe 24, with a pug nose, auburn hair, and a gap between his teeth. He'd make the perfect co-star on a wholesome family TV show. How'd she pay for the tickets?
Cash. I mean, who'd have thunk?
Did she say anything in particular at the time?
Not really. She seemed jazzed, and we joked some about Montezuma's revenge and stuff like that. I knew she was married, and I was asking her all about who was keeping the kids and what her old man was going to do while she was gone. God, I never in a million years guessed she was pulling off a scam like that, you know?
Did you ask why she was going to Argentina by herself?
Well, yeah, and she said it was a surprise.
He shrugged.
It didn't make much sense, but she was laughing like a kid, and I thought I just didn't get the joke.
I asked for a copy of the itinerary, such as it was. She had paid for a round-trip ticket, but there were no reservations coming back. Maybe she intended to cash in the return ticket once she got down there. I tucked the travel docs onto my clipboard, along with a copy of her medical forms. Something about this whole deal had begun to chafe, but I couldn't figure out quite why. Thanks for your help, I said, heading toward the door.
No problem. I guess the other guy didn't either.
I paused, mid-stride, turning back. Get what?
The joke. I heard him next door, and they were fighting like cats and dogs. He was pissed.
I stared at him. What time was this?
5:15, something like that. They were closed, and so were we, but Dad wanted me to stick around for a while until the cleaning crew got here. He owns this place, which is how I got in the business myself. These new guys were starting, and he wanted me to make sure they understood what to do.
Are you going to be here for a while?
Sure.
Good. The police may want to hear about this. I went back into the escrow office with mental alarm bells clanging away like crazy. Both Barbara Hemdahl and Mrs. Merriman had opted to eat lunch in. Or maybe the cops had ordered them to stay where they were. The bookkeeper sat at her desk with a sandwich, apple, and a carton of milk neatly arranged in front of her, while Mrs. Merriman picked at something in a plastic container she must have brought in from a fast food place. How's it going? Barbara Hemdahl spoke up from her side of the room.
The detectives went off for a search warrant so they can get in all the lockers back there, collecting evidence.
Only one of them is locked, I pointed out. She shrugged.
I guess they can't even peek without the paperwork.
Mrs. Merriman spoke up then, her expression tinged with guilt.
Yeah, actually, they asked the rest of us if we'd open our lockers voluntarily. So of course we did.
Mrs. Merriman and Barbara Hemdahl exchanged a look. And? Mrs. Merriman colored slightly.
There was an overnight case in Mr. Sutherland's locker, and I guess the things in it were hers.
Is it still back there?
Well, yes, but they left a uniformed officer on guard so nobody'd walk off with it. They've got everything spread out on the copy machine.
I went through the rear of the office, peering into the storage room. I knew the guy on duty, and he didn't object to my doing a visual survey of the items, as long as I didn't touch anything. The overnight case had been packed with all the personal belongings women like to keep on hand in case the rest of the luggage gets sent to Mexicali by mistake. I spotted a toothbrush and toothpaste, slippers, a filmy nightie, prescription drugs, hairbrush, extra eyeglasses in a case. Tucked under a change of underwear, I spotted a round plastic container, slightly convex, about the size of a compact. Gag. Gavin Sutherland was still sitting at his desk when I stopped by his office. His skin tone was gray and his shirt was hanging out, big rings of sweat under each arm. He was smoking a cigarette with an air of a man who's quit the habit and has taken it up again under duress. A second uniformed officer was standing just inside the door to my right. I leaned against the frame, but Gavin scarcely looked up. I said, "You knew what she was doing, but you thought she'd take you with her when she left." His smile was bitter.
Yeah, life's full of surprises.
I was going to have to tell Robert Ackerman what I'd discovered, and I dreaded it. As a stalling maneuver, just to demonstrate what a good girl I was, I drove over to the police station first and dropped off the data I'd collected, filling them in on the theory I'd come up with. They didn't exactly pin a medal on me, but they weren't as pissed off as I thought they'd be, given the number of civil codes I'd violated in the process. They were even moderately courteous, which is unusual in their treatment of me. Unfortunately, none of it took that long, and before I knew it, I was standing at the Ackerman's front door again. I rang the bell and waited, bad jokes running through my head. Well, there's good news and bad news, Robert. Good news is we've wrapped it up with hours to spare, so you won't have to pay me the full $300 we agreed to. The bad news is your wife's a thief, she's probably dead, and we're just getting out a warrant now because we think we know where the body's stashed. The door opened, and Robert was standing there with a finger to his lips.
The kids are down for their naps.
I nodded elaborately, pantomiming my understanding as though the silence he'd imposed required this special behavior on my part. He motioned me in, and together we tiptoed through the house and out to the backyard, where we continued to talk in low tones. I wasn't sure which bedroom the little rugrats slept in, and I didn't want to be responsible for waking them. Half a day of playing papa to the boys had left Robert looking disheveled and sorely in need of relief.
I didn't expect you back this soon.
I found myself whispering too, feeling anxious at the sense of secrecy. It reminded me of grade school somehow, the smell of autumn hanging in the air, the two of us perched on the edge of the sandbox like little kids, conspiring. I didn't want to break his heart, but what was I to do? "I think we've got it wrapped up," I said. He looked at me for a moment, apparently guessing from my expression that the news wasn't good.
"Is she okay?"
"We don't think so," I said. And then I told him what I'd learned, starting with the embezzlement and the relationship with Gavin, taking it right through to the quarrel the travel agent had heard. Robert was way ahead of me.
"She's dead, isn't she?"
"We don't know it for a fact, but we suspect as much." He nodded, tears welling up. He wrapped his arms around his knees and propped his chin on his fists. He looked so young. I wanted to reach out and touch him.
"She was really having an affair?"
"You must have suspected as much. You said she was restless and excited for months. Didn't that give you a clue?" He shrugged one shoulder, using the sleeve of his t-shirt to dash at the tears trickling down his cheeks.
"I don't know. I guess."
"And then you stopped by the office Friday afternoon and found her getting ready to leave the country. That's when you killed her, isn't it?" He froze, staring at me. At first, I thought he'd deny it, but maybe he realized there wasn't any point. He nodded mutely. "And then you hired me to make it look good, right?" He made a kind of squeaking sound in the back of his throat and sobbed once, his voice reduced to a whisper again.
"She shouldn't have done it. Betrayed us like that. We loved her so much."
"Have you got the money here?"
"I wasn't going to pay your fee out of that. We really did have a little fun so we could go up to San Diego one day."
"I'm sorry things didn't work out."
"I didn't do so bad, though, did I? I mean, I could have gotten away with it, don't you think?"
I'd been talking about the trip to the zoo. He thought I was referring to his murdering his wife. Talk about poor communication. God. "Well, you nearly pulled it off," I said. Shit, I was sitting there trying to make the guy feel good. He looked at me piteously, eyes red and flooded, his mouth trembling.
"Where did I slip? What did I do wrong?"
"You put her diaphragm in the overnight case you packed. You thought you'd shift suspicion onto Gavin Sutherland, but you didn't realize she'd had her tubes tied." A momentary rage flashed through his eyes and then flickered out. I suspected that her voluntary sterilization was more insulting to him than the affair with her boss.
"Jesus, I don't know what she saw in him. He was such a pig."
"Well, if it's any comfort to you, she wasn't going to take him with her either. She just wanted her freedom, you know?" He pulled out a handkerchief and blew his nose, trying to compose himself. He mopped his eyes, shivering with tension.
Well, how can you prove it, though, without a body? Do you know where she is?
I think we do. The sandbox, Robert. Right under us. He seemed to shrink.
God. Oh, God, don't turn me in. I'll give you the money. I don't give a damn. Just let me stay here with my kids. The little guys need me. I did it for them. I swear I did. You don't have to tell the cops, do you?
I shook my head and opened my shirt collar, showing him the mic. I don't have to tell a soul. I'm wired for sound. And then I looked over toward the side yard. For once, I was glad to see Lieutenant Dolan amble into view.
You've been listening to She Didn't Come Home, a short story by Sue Grafton, one of her Kinsey Millhone
stories. We've got a few minutes here for the top of the hour, and Joe Woods with the TV
show. Yeah, Joe Woods is going to get here pretty soon. So we've got a few minutes, like I said there. This is an old broadcast from about 5 years ago. I haven't played it before. Darn, it sounded pretty good, I thought. Let's see. I have got some music here lined up, and so we'll play some music here to bring us up to Joe Woods and the Tiki Cha Cha Club. Thank you.
dig this jive once more. Bye.
Right on down to
oh, boy.
Right
oh, can't you hear those hemp cats call? Come on, boys, let's have a ball. The Jim Jam Jump is a jumping jive. Makes you dig your kicks on the bellow side. Hep, hep. Hep, hep. The Jim Jam Jump is a solid jive. Makes you 9 foot tall. You 4 foot five. Hep, hep. Hep, hep. Ah, don't you be that Icaroo. You get hep, come on, follow through. You get your study foo. You make the joint jump like the gators do. The Jim Jam Jump is a jumping jive. Makes you like your rakes on the jersey side. Hep, hep. Hep, hep. The Jim Jam Jumping Jive makes you have hep on the hella side. Jim Jam Jump is a jumping jive. Makes you dig your kicks on the mellow side. Hep, hep. Hep, hep. Jump is a solid jive. Makes you 9 foot tall when you're 4 foot five. Hip, hip. Hip, hip. Oh, don't you be that Icaroo. You get hip, come on, and then you follow through. You get your study foo. You make the joint jump like the gators do. The Jim Jam Jump is a jumping jive. Makes you like your eggs on the jersey side. Hip, hip. Jive makes you have it on the mahala side. Tibbidi bidi 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 bidi
Ivan Jones with Dream On, Little Dreamer. Cab Calloway with Jump and Jive. And we started off with Dave Apollon with Love Me or Leave Me. This has been the Gremlin Time. I'm going to play a song here at the end that's going to take us to a place that Joe Woods promises to take us to, but he never does. He never does. This is the Firehouse 5 Plus 2 with the Isle of Capri. We'll see you next month.
Stay tuned for the Tiki Cha Cha Club.
Glad to see you all aboard.
Ole, ole, it's show time.
In the tiki 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 room, in the tiki 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 room,
all the birds sing words and the flowers croon.
In the tiki 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 room.
Welcome to our tropical hideaway, you lucky people, you. If we weren't in the show starting right away, we'd be the audience too.
All together in the tiki 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 room, in the tiki 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 room.
All the birds sing words and the flowers croon.
In the tiki 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 room.
Our show is delightful, we hope you'll agree. We hope that it fills you with pleasure and glee. Because if we don't make you feel like that, we're gonna wind up on the lady's hat.
In the tiki 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 room. In the tiki 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 room.
All the birds sing words and the flowers croon.
In the tiki 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 room.
Oh, it's a load up.
In the tiki 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 room. In the tiki 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 room. All the birds sing words and the flowers croon.
in the tiki 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 room.
Taking you to faraway places and bringing them home to you. This is the Tiki Cha-Cha Club, where the Cocktail Nation meets Exotica at the corner of Kalakaua Boulevard and Bourbon Street.